We have no intention of closing down Eielson. It's a very important base for us. It's important in terms of the role that we want to be able to play with regards to the Pacific.
Some assurances from senior Pentagon officials at a U.S. Senate hearing. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 13th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, no night sky, no problem. Astronomers land in Anchorage for their summer convention.
For a summer meeting, it's the largest one in a long time. So I think Anchorage and Alaska were quite the draw.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Someone you know is likely a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans, mhtrust.org.
Federal prosecutors began closing statements today in the trial of Fairbanks militia leader Schaefer Cox and his companions. Assistant U.S. Attorney Stephen Scrocky says the men were working on establishing another form of government. The men are charged with conspiring to murder government officials and to possess unregistered weapons, including handguns with silencers and hand grenades. Scrocky told jurors the evidence over 5 weeks of testimony shows the men were ready to kill federal law enforcement officials while protecting Cox at a television station appearance and had compiled a list of officials who would have been targeted. Top Pentagon officials at a Senate budget hearing today were grilled about the plan to move an F-16 squadron from Eielson Air Force Base to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Senator Lisa Murkowski asked Defense Secretary Leon Panetta and General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to try to get the Air Force to abandon the plan until it was better studied. Panetta defended the plan as necessary to meet congressional mandates to reduce spending. Dempsey said he had been hearing a lot from Alaska's senators about the plan and promised to look into it.
I won't commit to going back and talking them out of their plan. I will commit to you to go back and make sure I understand their plan better, and then I'll engage with you on it personally, you and Senator Begich.
Secretary Panetta sought to assure Murkowski that the plan was solely motivated by budget considerations and was definitely not part of a scheme to shut down Eielson.
I just want you to know, and I've shared this with your colleague as well, that we have no intention of closing down Eielson. It's a very important base for us. It's important in terms of air refueling. It's important in terms of the role that we want to be able to play with regards to the Pacific. And so nothing that is being recommended here in any way is intended to impact on Eielson itself as a future base for the Air Force.
But Murkowski said she was not convinced, pointing to plans to tear down some of Eielson's buildings.
Part of the proposed savings that the Air Force is looking to is demolishing several buildings within Eielson. The replacement value of these is about $150 million. So it puts it in a situation where it would appear to be kind of a backdoor BRAC, and that is the concern, the consideration.
BRAC stands for Base Realignment and Closure and is the procedure for deciding which bases to close. It was intended to take some of the politics out of the process, but it requires congressional authorization, which is considered extremely unlikely at present. Alaska's Department of Education and Early Development is preparing to seek a waiver from provisions of No Child Left Behind. KDLG's Ariel Van Cleve reports.
Last year, the Obama administration announced it would let states avoid certain aspects of the education law if those states met other conditions. Alaska Department of Education spokesperson Eric Fry says the state board has already adopted new standards in English and math, which is one element necessary to receive a waiver. But he says there are two other requirements.
A teacher evaluation program that to some extent takes into account student achievement in evaluating teachers and principals. And the third element would be we'd have to devise our own accountability system for schools, in other words, deciding which schools need help and which don't.
No Child Left Behind has higher targets each year regarding students who are considered proficient in English and math. Eventually, 100% of students are expected to reach these standards or face certain consequences, such as diverting funds to focus on tutoring or imposing a new curriculum. Fry calls it a no-win situation for the schools.
What a waiver would allow us to do is start fresh with our own accountability system. We'd be able to throw away all that element of No Child Left Behind that's just impossible for schools to meet and come up with something that's ambitious but possible. In other words, we keep striving for more and more kids to be proficient, but we don't set an impossible goal that demoralizes everyone and stigmatizes schools.
He says avoiding certain provisions in the law could help the state focus more directly on what's working and what isn't, rather than making blanket changes.
The state doesn't have a completely free hand to do whatever it wishes for accountability. There are certain rules they're going to ask states to follow. But within those rules, there's much more latitude than under the traditional No Child Left Behind.
Fry says the state will file a waiver request by early September. He expects the application to be volleyed between the state and the federal government before winning final approval. In Dillingham, I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
Alaska's rural villages are getting help from the most recent technological advances in energy-saving power systems. The Alaska Energy Authority hosted a rural energy open house in Anchorage today to show off its latest services to the bush, among them a state-of-the-art modular powerhouse destined for shipment to Akiak. From the outside, the powerhouse looks like a typical ATCO unit, but inside it looks more like the bridge of the Starship Enterprise. Chris Noonan is a manager for AEA's Rural Power System Program.
This is a complete power plant. It's a powerhouse module. We've basically looked at the requirements of what the community needs for loads to keep the power on, and we've built this around what that need is. This will be granted to the community. It was funded through the Denali Commission in the state. It was a 50-50 match on it. So once this gets out and installed in the community, it actually gets granted over to them, and they're responsible for maintaining the system when it's done.
Noonan says replacing old, inefficient power systems with electronic equipment like the new powerhouse is helping rural Alaska save fuel expenses. The powerhouse drew quite a crowd of admirers, among them Rick Toussaint, who helped build the units and others like it. He says the unit redirects what once was wasted heat so that it can be used to heat additional areas.
So the generator will produce heat like your car, go through these manifolds, and then this heat exchanger will transfer the heat to these pipes, which are going to, in effect, then go underground, and they'll go heat the other buildings.
AEA intern Corey Fetters says the new powerhouses in rural Alaska can be monitored remotely by computers in Anchorage. He points to a bank of computers lining a long table and brings up Unalakleet on one of the screens.
So right now we have Unalakleet going up. You got each generator. Since they have a wind farm up there, we monitor the wind farm and the wind turbines. You see each wind turbine, where you can go into each generator and see the RPM, oil pressure, the status of each engine.
With remote capability, Anchorage technicians can help on-site power operators to diagnose problems. AEA is working to replace old, inefficient power systems in the bush with diesel-fueled powerhouses as part of its Rural Power Upgrades program, which is done in cooperation with the Denali Commission. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, solving one of the biggest problems for gardeners in Alaska.
Just a few more degrees is what you need to produce food. Out there, it's just a little bit too cold for most of the things that we're used to eating.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
A group of disabled veterans landed on the Kehiltna Glacier Monday to begin their attempt to climb Mount McKinley. The group is part of the Disabled Sports USA's Wounded Warfighter Program, which encourages veterans to overcome physical setbacks to participate in sports at all levels. The Denali expedition will be led by Disabled Sports USA's Executive Director Kirk Bauer. Bauer lost a leg in 1969 while serving as infantry in Vietnam. He is leading four men who lost limbs fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. Bauer says in recent years, Disabled Sports USA has upped the intensity of offerings for wounded soldiers.
Disabled Sports USA and our participants have been part of tests that show that amputees can expend 100% or more energy doing a similar activity to a person who has all their appendages. And so the first thing that I tell these warriors and that I have to keep in mind for myself is that we actually have to train harder because we have to be in better shape to meet these challenges because of the extra energy expenditures.
The prosthetic legs used by the wounded warriors are advanced using materials like carbon fiber. Some of the components are even computer controlled, so the group will be bringing solar charges to power up the batteries in their artificial limbs. Bauer says all the climbers have their own reason for reaching the top of North America's highest peak, but he says they have one thing in common.
All the warriors want to really show their brothers and sisters who are still in the service, who have been hit recently, who may be injured in the future, let them, give them a really strong message that they can really do anything despite the fact that they have been literally blown up and lost sometimes two and three limbs in the accident, in the combat, and that they can get back and be active in a number of different sports. So they're trying to provide that example that will inspire the other wounded warriors to get out of bed and to get back into sports, no matter what the sport is.
The Warfighter Sports McKinley Expedition began on June 11th. The team expects the trip to take 22 days. Even though thousands of cargo ships pass through Alaska waters every year, most of that traffic passes through pretty quietly. That's in part because Alaska requires marine pilots on board many of these vessels to help their captains navigate dangerous situations. The pilots operating out of the port of Dutch Harbor have a particularly challenging job. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has this profile of one of Unalaska's longest-serving pilots.
Over the past two decades, Pete Garay has navigated some very big ships through Unalaska's waters in a very understated way.
We're kind of like valet car parkers.
Garay works for the Alaska Marine Pilots, a group that's tasked with safely maneuvering foreign flag ships and supersized vessels into the port of Dutch Harbor. Garay's metaphor is actually sort of perfect. Once vessels get close to their destination, the Marine Pilots are delivered over and then take control from the captain, basically taking the keys from them. Gray says it's a lot easier than working on an oil tanker or aboard a factory trawler like he did in his youth.
That was real hard work, 18, 20 hours a day on the back deck, waist deep in either a pile of shrimp or rockfish, or down in the hold back in the day before we had refrigeration, we had to use ice. And the captain I worked with was too cheap to buy new ice each trip, so we'd have to go down and chip and break and smash the ice each time we pulled a tow up. So I'd see the ships going back and forth going, boy, that would be good. How do I get from here over to there?
Of course, the job isn't as effortless as Gray makes it sound. Ports Director Peggy McLaughlin works closely with the pilots, and she says they're a major reason why marine traffic runs so smoothly in an area with such treacherous waters.
The pilots out here are probably, in my opinion, some of the most taxed, if you will, in terms of what they deal with for weather conditions and judgment calls. You know, if they're moving vessels in and out of the Puget Sound, you're going to have some lousy weather days, but you're not going to have the same judgment calls that you have to make here, you know, virtually October through April.
Garay is one of the island's oldest marine pilots, and this month he made his last trip through Unalaska Bay. While he's not retiring, he is relocating to South Central Alaska, where he can keep doing this job all while being closer to his family. In his 22 years in Unalaska, Garay was able to see how the groundfish boom affected the port, help implement marine safety policy, and take the lead on a few big adventures. Most recently, he was a pilot aboard the tanker Renda, which made headlines when it transported much-needed fuel to iced-in Nome. He says that was a difficult journey, and not just because of the ice. There was also the lack of creature comforts. The
Russians are very Spartan ships. They don't have a lot of amenities. So I had borscht 3 times a day, but I like borscht. You know, I'm Hungarian. I'm used to soup, so that was good.
Then again, the Renda wasn't without some perks.
They had a sauna, and that was really killer. I'll tell you, it's an experience to go from 140 degrees to minus 60.
The journey aboard the Renda took about 2 weeks and was done in some of the worst conditions Garay had ever seen. The weather was foul, and the ice sheets were as tall as any human being. He says that having a pilot aboard helped facilitate communications between the U.S. Coast Guard and the Russian crew aboard the Renda. Having a pilot on for the whole journey instead of just the last leg provided further insurance against a potential disaster, Garay says.
That's called sleeve oil, keeping a little extra up your sleeve. It's an engineer term of art to make sure you've always got a little extra on your side. Well, when they proposed the Renda voyage to Nome, we weren't going in springtime or at the end of winter, like now with the ice breaking up. We're going in the absolute worst possible time.
While Garay was a fisherman before becoming a marine pilot, he was nearly a lawyer before that. He majored in political science in college, and he mentions that the education proved useful when helping coordinate the Renda trip. Garay says that while it's an unlikely background for a marine pilot to have, it's one that's helped him often.
Every day. I love politics. There are a lot of politics involved with the business of safety, if you will.
Beyond aiding him with Russian-American relations, Garay's political background also enabled him to help shape marine policy in the Aleutians. He worked with Unalaska Mayor Shirley Marcourt in lobbying for an emergency mooring buoy, and he was also involved in the creation of the emergency towing system, which makes it easier to rescue distressed vessels. Ports Director Peggy McLaughlin says that Unalaska's waters would look a lot different if Garay and other marine pilots weren't around.
From a historical standpoint, we would be missing a lot of the safety factors that we have in place right now, inclusive of, you know, severe weather anchoring and ETS programs and, you know, certain best practices that are followed because of their knowledge of maneuvering vessels in and out of here.
Garay says that there's plenty more work to be done, especially with Unalaska likely to develop into a major oil and gas hub. And he adds that the other marine pilots will continue to find ways to handle increased vessel traffic. He sees support expanding over the next decade, and he says he'll miss the chance to see Unalaska's marine facilities grow.
I'm a wharf rat. That's what I love about the Aleutians. I love just being on the waterfront, and I don't have to wear a suit and tie to work.
Garay will continue his piloting career in Homer, where, he says, he will continue to avoid wearing suits. In Unalaska, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
Doyon Limited is waiting for the final report from oil and gas field work conducted in the Nanana Basin last winter. The Interior Alaska Native Corporation conducted 100 miles worth of seismic work in the basin. Doyon President and CEO Aaron Schutt says the corporation has not developed a timeline for production yet.
Our commitment is to process the data and really look for a place to drill an exploration well. Whether or not the data shows us a place that's worthy of spending a lot of money drilling is a different, that's out of our hands. What's in the ground is in the ground. We sure hope to be lucky.
Governor Sean Parnell signed a bill into law last month that provides tax credits and incentives to help bring oil and gas in frontier basins to market. Schutt calls the bill one of the most important pieces of legislation Doyon has seen in years.
What we do next will be dramatically impacted by that, both on the tax credit part and also on production, if you find anything. Production tax changes encourage partners, and Doyon's not big enough to do a big oil and gas development on its own, so if we find anything, we'll have to find a partner. This legislation is very helpful on both parts.
Doyon Limited holds exploration rights to more than 500,000 acres of state land between the villages of Nanana and Minto.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has over 70 job openings available statewide in nursing, social work, and child protection.
There's nothing more important than protecting the health and well-being of Alaska families, so take the first step towards a meaningful career. Visit dhss.alaska.gov and click on Careers. Join their team and make a difference every day. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The American Astronomical Society convention landed in Alaska for the first time ever this week. It's bringing over 1,000 scientists and astronomy lovers from all over the world to Anchorage. At a public event last night, NASA scientists from the Kepler mission spoke about their findings in their quest to discover habitable planets outside Earth. APRN's Wendy Jonasson has the story.
At Cirnos Theater Company in downtown Anchorage, scientists from the Kepler mission prepare to give their presentation. It's just one of many talks scientists will give this week for the conference, but this one is a little different. The NASA scientists are drinking Alaskan Ambers, and before the serious lecture begins, a crowd of about 50 is getting ready for a round of science trivia. Wendy Winthrow helps coordinate the Anchorage Science Pub gathering that normally happens at Taproot every other Sunday. Cirnos is hosting on this night because of the American Astronomical Society convention.
Remember not to talk too loud so that other teams next to you can get the answers from you. Unless you want to throw in a red herring and say, oh, I'm sure it's this, when it's really something else.
Even the scientists are invited to join in the trivia fun, including NASA's Steve Howell.
Yeah, I'm kind of hoping that the trivia that I actually know most of the questions, because I'd feel a little embarrassed if they ask an astronomy question I don't know it.
It turns out that the scientists, including Howell, didn't know all the answers, but they were all still smiling, happy to be in Alaska among the hundreds of others that flocked here this week for the AAS meeting. Howell says they didn't have any trouble convincing astronomers to show up.
For a meeting in the summer, there's meetings in January and June every year. For a summer meeting, it's the largest one in a long time. So I think Anchorage and Alaska were quite the draw.
And what enticed the astronomers to come to a place with virtually no night sky for their summer conference? Howell has a theory that connects a childhood spent gazing into the sky and all the outdoor activities that Alaska offers.
Many astronomers grew up with telescopes in their backyard or being outside at night. And, oh man, mountains and lakes and glaciers and outdoor stuff. If you're interested in outdoors, how can you not love Alaska?
And it's not just scientists who are excited about the AAS meeting. Anchorage residents and self-proclaimed science nerds are also attending some of the lectures and events. Peter Bradley, a freelance writer, noticed the downtown crowds before he knew about the conference.
I saw in the Denina Center that there was a whole bunch of like NASA stuff up. And then at Dark Horse, if you go by, there's just this full of nerds.
But beer, trivia, and the chance to rub shoulders with NASA scientists weren't the reasons that Bradley made it to the pub event. Bradley was interested to hear the Kepler scientists talk about the possibility of a habitable planet other than Earth.
The idea of aliens is exciting, and this is like the closest thing people are doing towards it. That's how I always see it presented, is it's like, well, exoplanets could hold. They're looking for planets that could hold life.
Two Kepler scientists told the Science Pub audience that there are 72 confirmed habitable planets besides Earth. They will continue to report their extraterrestrial findings throughout the week. Many other astronomers will be highlighting their work as well, spanning the range of topics from black holes to the correct definition of gravity. In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Jonasson.
When you think of food in Alaska, you might think of king salmon or moose. Farming is not really our forte, but some Alaskans are trying to change that, at least on a small scale. In Sitka, you can find two large transparent plastic tunnels for growing produce rising from a front yard. KCAW's Rachel Waldholtz took a look inside.
This month, Judy Johnstone plowed under the flower garden she'd cultivated for over 20 years. In its place, she erected a pair of unconventional structures. They look a little like...
like two very large igloos, 12 feet high, 24 feet long.
And 20 feet wide.
Covered in clear plastic.
These are high tunnels, low-tech alternatives to the conventional greenhouse. Plastic sheeting is stretched across steel ribs to create a shelter for vegetables planted in the ground. The high tunnels allow gardeners to stretch the growing season. Johnstone hopes to keep hers going year-round. Carrie McLean of the Sitka Local Foods Network helped build Johnstone's high tunnels.
Very simple structures, but if you step inside, you'll just see the difference between outside and inside.
Outside, it's about 59 degrees, but inside, it's a humid 75 or 80.
Just a few more degrees is what you need to produce food. Out there, it's just a little bit too cold for most of the things that we're used to eating.
Inside the high tunnel, rows of vibrant green starts poke out of furrows in the earth.
Here we have chard and broccoli and different brassicas, herbs, cilantro, onions, lettuce, things that can grow without protection, and some things that can't. Like here are all tomatoes.
Johnstone's high tunnels are part of a USDA program in which the agency reimburses gardeners for the cost of building the tunnels. In most of the country, the program is designed to conserve soil and cut down on the use of water and fertilizer. But in Southeast Alaska, the program's major benefit is food.
It's pretty challenging to grow food in Alaska.
This is Samia Savelle, who manages the program from the Natural Resources Conservation Service in Juneau.
And definitely in Southeast, where as everybody just experienced in May, we can have pretty cool temperatures and a lot of rain, and that limits the number and types of crops that you can grow, and certainly we have a short growing season. So I think the appeal is extending that growing season and giving people the opportunity to grow more of a variety of crops that might not otherwise be possible in our climate.
Johnstone and McLean say the program is perfect for Sitka, with its chilly summers, lack of farmland, and high food prices. High tunnels, they say, could be an excellent source of cheap local produce.
We don't want to add to the carbon footprint by flying all this lettuce and stuff in from Mexico. It's crazy. We can grow it here, and we should.
And the price of food has gone up 40% in the last 5 years in Sitka.
That's according to the Alaska Food Cost Survey, which found that the cost of food for a family of four in Sitka increased by nearly 44% between 2006 and 2011. That's compared to a 21% rise in Anchorage over the same 5 years. The deadline to apply for the USDA funding is this Friday, June 15th. The program does require some past horticultural experience.
You have to have some land and a desire, and you have to have grown something. They've really made it flexible for Alaska, so if you've grown a potted geranium on your front porch, you will qualify. That's farmer enough for Alaska. But you have to combine it with some other $1,000 worth of something that you've gotten from the land. So that could be sockeye or deer, or if you're further north, moose.
Johnstone is one of about 40 people in Southeast Alaska who have applied for the grant in the past 3 years. And she's looking forward to a productive season.
How much produce do you expect to grow this summer?
Lots. Lots.
In Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org or follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ariel Van Cleve in Dillingham, Lorian Nettleton in Talkeetna, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka. APRN Steve Heimel and Wendy Jonathan reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I am Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. You probably know a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.